Good evening, everyone. Tonight is going to be a little bit different. Bible lecture where you go through a series of passages to get to a point where you conclude that X or Y is true. Tonight, what we're trying to do is think about a question that might be useful when we're discussing with individuals who maybe don't have a faith or maybe have a completely different faith, that it might just be something that's a sort of fundamental position that everyone kind of has. That actually is probably worth just unpicking briefly this evening. Now, I'm always told that I go too quickly, and tonight it's almost a guarantee that I'll go too quickly. But I hope at the very least, if at the end you get the broad sketch of the argument, that's the main thing. So what we're going to do is we're going to do three things. We'll say, firstly, try and explain what the question is that we're asking. The second question is, second part of this evening, we'll go through a bit of the evidence for it. And then thirdly, we'll think about what that means for everyone, really, but I guess particularly us. What does that mean? So what? So let's start by thinking about what we mean, or what I mean, rather, by this question. So the question we've asked is, does Christianity have an influence on the way we all think today? And it's probably just worth caveating a few of these things. So when I'm talking about Christianity here, I am talking about Christianity in the broadest sense, not the sort of very narrowish sense about a set group of believers within the wider Christian community. I'm talking about Christianity in its broadest sense. And I guess the other bit, or two other bits that might be worth pulling out, when I'm talking about all, I mean predominantly people who live in the West. So people in, well, most people in the UK, I would argue, fall into this category. People in the US, in most Western countries, Europe, so on. They're the all I'm really talking about here. And when I'm talking about thinking here, I'm not necessarily trying to get to whether you're thinking about whether you're going to have a shower or not. I'm trying to get here to the foundations about why we think the things that we think, the things that we value, and so on. Okay, hopefully that makes sense in terms of what I'm trying to tackle. So before I go into this, it's well worth saying that I'm leaning very heavily on a few things that I've read. That I would actually recommend in a various sort of with all the normal caveats applying, and I have no particularly special knowledge about literally anything in the whole world, let alone sociology and the things we're going to think about tonight. So I am very much leaning on the work of others, and I think there's nothing wrong at all with doing so. So there's three books that I'm using to draw on here. You may have read some of them. Some of them are quite well known. Some of them are sort of in the bestseller lists. So I'll just work my way through them. So there's the book on the left called The Weirdest People in the World, which I'll explain about in a second. The middle book is a book about the history of humankind by an Israeli scholar. And then the one on the right is by one of our probably most well-known modern historians, a chap by the name of Tom Holland. And his book is called Dominion. It's about the making of the Western mind. And the reason for flagging these three books is I want to try and show that what I'm going to present tonight is not something that's highly coloured by the fact that I myself am a Christian. And the reason I'm saying that is important because all three of these authors, as far as I'm aware, are not Christians. So you've got on the left-hand side, the first book that was published in 2011 by this Jewish scholar, Yuval Noah Harari. He, I'm very confident, is either an atheist or agnostic based on the way he writes. The middle one, the Dominion, which was published 2 years ago, is by Tom Holland. He is an agnostic. And then the third one, that The Weirdest People in the World book, is written by a professor of human evolutionary biology at Harvard. And he, again, as far as I can tell, is an agnostic, but he's never publicly stated it. But I'd be surprised if he was a Christian based on some of the things he writes. So I hope, at the very least, what I've tried to say in the first 5 minutes is, this is a very broad topic we're thinking about, and are relying on the work of others, which I think is helpful, because if we're talking to someone who, for example, doesn't believe anything about Christianity, they're probably more likely going to be able to take some of this from people who, I guess, have a similar ideological position than we do, if that makes sense. Someone who's maybe not a Christian than is a Christian. Now, of course, there are many Christian books that make the same points as these, but I'm using these as a reference point to illustrate the point. I hope that makes sense. So moving on, let's think about the evidence. So I guess this question is there, what does Christianity in the broadest sense influence the way we think today? Well, let's start really, really, really obvious stuff. Think about maybe schooling or the calendar we use Or you might be thinking I'm talking about the Queen here. I'm not. You'll see what I'm talking about in a second. So schools, about a third of state schools in the UK are, nominally at least, Christian. So they're founded on Christian principles, many of them Roman Catholic. Equally, Church of England schools make up about another half of the schools in the UK of that 33%. So it does that influence the way we think? Probably on some level. Yeah, there's definitely an influence there, but it's quite a light touch one. The second one is the calendar. So our UK calendar is based on the calendar that is often called the Gregorian calendar, which was set up by someone who was a Christian. So does that influence the way we think? Probably, yeah. Like, I mean, simple stuff like we have Sundays off work. That's and there's even things even now, like Sunday trading laws, which were built on this principle of the Sabbath, which comes from scripture on some level. Okay, but you'd probably think, well, yeah, does that really have a dramatic influence on the sort of foundations of what people think? Well, probably not, but there is influence of Christianity at this sort of macro level. And then the last of these three sort of really big themes is that actually many of our public holidays are directly tied to Christian festivals. Easter, Christmas, you see the Whitsun, they're all fundamental at the foundational level. They have Christian origins. So I think anyone would accept that. That's a pretty obvious set of points, that there is a level of influence that Christianity has on society in the West, even today. But that's not really, I think, what I'm trying to get to today. So let's think a little bit wider and a little bit deeper about some of the fundamental principles of Christianity that even today influence society in the West at large. So the first one I'm going to pick is actually marriage. Okay, and the argument that one of those authors makes at great length in his book is that the principle of Christian monogamy, so that is one man, one woman for life as marriage partners, has had a profound impact on society in the West. Now, let me show you on the next slide a chart that if any of you have ever seen before, I would be surprised. And it's about the testosterone level in men in their early 20s. And I told you tonight it was going to be exciting, didn't I? So what we're looking at here on this chart is the impact of how much testosterone declines in men between when they're 21 and a half, which I think we'd all accept probably men at 21 and a half have quite a lot of testosterone. And we're seeing how it declines based on their marriage status and based on whether they've had kids between when they're 21 and a half to when they're 26 and a half. So a period of 5 years. And what you can see, and this was done on a sample of many, many thousands of people from lots of different countries in the West, globally this was done. And you can see on the left-hand side that if you were unmarried at the age of 26 and a half, your testosterone level had dropped from when you were 21 and a half by about 20%. So not an immaterial drop of testosterone in those men. However, if you'd been married, it dropped about 30%. And if you had children and you were married, it dropped about 55%. So in and of itself, I think that's just quite an interesting sort of scientific fact that if you're married, you're likely to have less testosterone. If you're married with kids, you really do have a sort of fairly precipitous drop in the amount of testosterone you have. So you might think, what is he rabbiting on about? Like, how is this relevant to this principle of society? Well, so this is the book I mentioned, The Weirdest People in the World. And this author is talking about the impact of marriage. And you'll see why that principle of testosterone is important in a second. And he says, Christian monogamy, the idea of being married to one man, one woman, was a particularly potent package for suppressing testosterone. Besides limiting men to one wife, it constrained men from seeking sex outside marriage, visiting prostitutes, having mistresses. And to accomplish that, the church worked hard to end prostitution and sexual slavery. The second point was the church made divorce very difficult, as Henry VIII would find out, which prevented men from engaging in serial monogamy. And this was a massive change in society with other ancient societies. So, for example, if you're in Athens or in ancient Rome, before Christianity really hit the world, you would have what would be called a monogamous society, in that one man would be married to one woman. But that didn't stop the men also going sleeping with other women or having male prostitutes or anything like that. And the difference that Christian monogamy provided is that it meant, as genuinely meant, one man, one woman for life, but it stopped the other bits of sort of outside of marriage sex going on. And also they worked hard to protect things like prostitution, to stop prostitution, protect women, and make sure that the sort of this principle of monogamy actually meant monogamy in this instance. So I think that's quite an interesting fact that we'll think about in a little sec. So he goes on in this book to then talk a little bit about the societal power that had all around the Western world, or where Christianity influenced society. And he goes on to talk about this point that, he talks at the top. Numerous studies support the view that getting married in a monogamous society reduces a man's likelihood of both committing crimes and abusing alcohol and drugs. And if you've ever read anything about this topic, you'll see that testosterone levels, particularly high testosterone levels, are linked for things like alcohol abuse, drugs and crime and so on. So what the point is here, because Christianity was pushed in these societies and that men and women were encouraged to marry and stay together, often from a relatively young age, the amount of testosterone in society at large dropped quite radically. And those societies, from an economic point of view, did quite well because their crime levels dropped, their alcohol abuse level dropped, their drug level dropped. And as a result, those societies took off. And one of the suggestions he makes, which I think seems plausible, is that is partly why the West was the cradle for the Industrial Revolution. That it was built on this principle that actually there was this stable family unit that was a sort of foundation on which society was built. And the contrast, I guess, by sort of for obvious reasons, is that if you're in a society where you don't have this principle of monogamy, one man and one woman, where you have one man with many women, what that means is you have a lot of men who aren't married, which means you have a lot more testosterone, a lot more crime, a lot more issues, as he talks about in the bottom of this paragraph, of criminal behaviour and other social ills over their entire lives. Quite an interesting factor, I think, just to think about. So that's a sort of point around sort of monogamy. And then the last point I think that I would make on this is a very important one, is that whereas if you went into the ancient world, it was not where you would never expect to see that the king would be judged by the same standards as a poor person. The principle that Christianity brought in was that everyone, rich or poor, had to be held to the same sexual ethic, if you like. So he talks about here in the early part of this paragraph, a great social achievement of the early Middle Ages was the imposition of the same sexual and domestic conduct on both the rich and the poor, the king in his palace, the peasant in his hovel, neither was exempt. Okay. Now, it didn't stop people doing it, but the point was it was frowned upon by society at large. And his suggestion at the end of this is it's very likely that the fairer distribution of women across society helped reduce abductions and rapes and levels of violence generally in the early Middle Ages. Interesting, isn't it? I think I certainly hadn't thought that deeply personally about this principle of marriage. So there's one example. Just going to do two others that probably are more well known. The next one is around what I've called letters and learning. And I guess this is a fairly obvious one. I'm not going to go into this in any great detail, but the use of the book, as we would know it, this is a notebook, I accept, but like something that looks a bit like this rather than a scroll, it seems likely that the early Christian scribes, given the amount of text that they were copying, found that format was better. So it seems one of the legacies that Christian scribes have left on the world was books. Universities, schools were all, in the West at least, very often set up by Christian communities. That's another sort of really foundational level. Beneath it being a C of E school, the concept of teaching and education were definitely built in there. And then the last one of the examples that I think everyone would probably well understand is the principle of care of the sick, the poor, social justice, charity, hospitals. Many of these are founded on Judeo-Christian principles the world over, actually. And you still see today, don't you? Some of the most extraordinary work of care is done by Christian organisations in really, really challenging and trying circumstances. So we thought, I guess, at the start about this really sort of high level. Yeah, there's some sort of vague tentacles of Christianity still influencing the calendar or something like that, but it doesn't really matter. These next set we've thought about are a bit deeper, aren't they? They're sort of they sort of sit underneath the way that our society has worked or built, the West has been built, care, letters, learning, marriage, that's a sort of foundational level. But for the next sort of 10 minutes or so, before I try and draw some conclusions, I wanted to just think a little bit even deeper than that, actually, some sort of real underpinning factors in the way that we all think, whether we're a Christian or a non-Christian, that maybe influence the way we view the world. So we're kind of, if you like, working our way deeper into the human psyche as we go on. So we're going to think about two things here. And again, I'm sure some of these, both of these factors are things that you've probably all reflected on before, but I think they're useful just to think about. The first one is the principle that life is valuable, that every person has a value. Now, of course, that is a principle we see in the Jewish scriptures. It's also a principle we see in the Christian scriptures. And it's something that certainly Christianity really sort of catapulted into view, this principle that every life was important. And unless you think, well, surely every group of humans down through time have thought that, that's just not true. So a quote from Aristotle, he said, "Let there be a law that no deformed child would live." Okay, so that was not this, it, like, I think that'd be hard to tally with the principle of the sanctity of life. He had a view that deformed children shouldn't live. So this principle of sanctity of life, I'd suggest, is quite a important and powerful point that comes from a faith in the God of the Bible. This is really sort of landed very well, I think, in this book by this Jewish scholar. So this is a bit of scholarly wiffle waffle in here, but you'll bear with me. He says here, even though liberal humanism sanctifies humans, it believes that humans are more important than animals, it does not deny the existence of God, and is, in fact, founded on monotheist beliefs, the belief in one God. Without recourse, he suggests, to a creator God, it becomes embarrassingly difficult for liberals to expect what is so special about individual sapiens. There's a lot in there. The point he's making is humanism, this great principle that human beings are important and are special, he suggests is a view that you can entirely legitimately hold, but it's based on something that comes from the Bible, a creator God creating human beings that are special. And he says, well, if you're a liberal humanist, if you're someone who believes that, it's really hard to explain why you think that humans are more important than animals without recoursing to, well, the God of the Bible saying, I've created man in the image of God. That's his point. And he goes on, and it's a really sort of powerful argument I've certainly used with others who I know who don't believe anything. And I think this is a really foundational point that actually it's worth challenging people. Do you think human beings are special? Pretty much everyone would probably say yes. Why is that? What's the reason behind that? And his point here is actually this is one of those things that comes from Christianity, Judaism more generally, the Bible, I suppose, if you want to call it that. And he goes on and says, he's talking about a slightly different strand of humanism. He says the idea that all humans are equal is a revamped version of the monotheist conviction that all souls are equal before God. Yeah, so it's the same point. Just to sort of hit you hard with another quote that sort of basically makes the same point. This is right at the end of the book that Tom Holland wrote on how the Western mind has been built up. And he says here, without the biblical story that God had created humanity in his own image to draw upon, the reverence of humanists for their own species risks seeming mawkish and shallow. Humanism derives ultimately from claims made in the Bible that humans are made in God's image, that his son died equally for everyone, that there is neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, male nor female. And for those of you who know your Bibles well, you'll see exactly where he's quoting from there. It's Galatians chapter 3. So I think this is a really, really helpful point that if we're discussing, obviously gently, with people who maybe are of a view that there is no God, this is a potential area where we can sort of just gently ask questions about what is so special about humans? Why do you believe humans are sort of really important and that they're equal? What's the reason for that? And definitely pointing, I think, to these scholars is helpful here to illustrate where they actually get it from. And then just lastly, this is an article that was written in The Spectator, 7 years ago now, by a very interesting writer called Douglas Murray. And he actually makes this point that actually, if we take atheism to its ultimate conclusion, it really gets starts getting quite scary about human life. And he says, the more atheists think on these things, the more we may have to accept that the concept of the sanctity of human life is a Judeo-Christian notion, which might very easily not survive Judeo-Christian civilization. Those who do not believe in God and who stare over that cliff, much as Theo Hobson points out, very few atheists actually do, may realize that only three options remain open to us. The first option is to fall into the furnace, by which he means you just say humans aren't, that sanctity of life doesn't exist. Another is to work furiously to nail down an atheist version of the sanctity of the individual, which he suggests is hard. And thirdly, if that does not work, then there is only one other place to go, which is back to faith, whether we like it or not. So I'm conscious I've hit you there with about four or five different quotes from various books. If you're sort of thinking, God, this is boring, John, I guess to zoom back in, the point I'm making is that the principle that human life has a value and that it's consistent across every human being, contrasting deformed children don't deserve to live, that is something that fundamentally, it seems, comes from the concept that God has made men and women in his image. And that foundational principle seems to exist. Hopefully that makes sense. But definitely at the end, if that's been completely illogical, call me out on it. And then the sort of last part of the argument section, as it is, for the next sort of few minutes, is this principle about thinking about the world through the prism of good and evil. Yeah. So I'll try and give you some examples. But if I had some cauliflower on my plate and I don't like it, I would not say that cauliflower is evil, although at times perhaps some of you might be tempted to think that. That you'd never use that language to describe something like cauliflower. But you probably would use that language to talk about something horrendous, like a murder in cold blood. The world over, every single society has perceived that that is an objectively evil thing that happens. Okay. And this principle of good and evil, I'd suggest, again, has its sort of anchor points, its roots, its tentacles in Christianity. And so even today, when you hear arguments framed between maybe non-believers and believers, there is often this use of language, good and evil, will be infiltrating the speak of what people are saying. Again, I'd suggest that has a sort of Christian foundation. Let's try and illustrate that again with reference to some of these books by these historians. So he's talking here more broadly. So I'll just read the middle section. Even in Europe, a continent with churches far emptier than those in the United States, the trace elements of Christianity continued to infuse people's morals and presumptions so utterly that many failed even to detect their presence. Like dust particles so fine as to be invisible to the naked eye, they were breathed in equally by everyone, believers, atheists, and those who had never paused so much to think about religion. Had it been otherwise, then no one would ever have got woke, which is a term that's really been politicized in the last few years. And the point he's making is the way that we think as a society about good and evil is built on this principle of Christianity having morals. And his point is that many individuals, if they use that language, they won't even realize where that comes from. It's, I like that phrase, like dust particles so fine as to be invisible to the naked eye, but it infiltrates the way we think. And that's his point, actually, through this whole section of the book. He goes on to make a really interesting point at the end of this section, where he's challenging again, why do we as human beings think in these terms of good and evil? Yeah. What's the reason for thinking, for example, that Nazism was objectively evil? Why would you think that? And if you don't, people really balk at that. And his point is that here he goes on to say, just as this scholar had foretold, free thinkers who mock the very idea of a God as a dead thing, a skyfaring, an imaginary friend, still hold to taboos and morals that derive from Christianity. So I hope that point is making sense. It's not saying, to be really clear, that everyone will have exactly the same moral code as Christianity. It's saying that the fact that people think about the world through the prism of morality, of good and evil, is something that has come from Christianity in its broadest sense. Now, you might be sat there, particularly if you are not a believer, thinking, okay, I can buy all of that so far, but this is a very favourable reflection on Christianity. And it would be right of me to acknowledge that that is entirely true. Christianity, in the broadest sense, has done some objectively bad, or I would say evil things. Let me show you a picture here, and some of you probably know what this is. This is a painting by someone I've never heard of, and it depicts the First Crusade, where Christians went around killing people in their thousands. And there's been defences written of the Crusade, and I'm sure there are some legitimate reasons about why they were annoyed, but it seems to me that this stands in stark contrast with the principles of Christianity. And let me go further and say, there's probably, in my mind, two of the biggest things that have happened in the last two millennia that are objectively evil that have been done by Christians. Violence is number one. Christians have killed many other people, including, horrifyingly as it might seem, other Christians, and indeed others, and also slavery. It was not like the argument for slavery was all on one side, that all of the Christians were saying we need to abolish slavery, it's terrible. Christians have been on both sides, well, were on both sides of that for many hundreds of years. But the point I would suggest is that by me saying that those things are bad and are evil, I am recoursing myself to the principles of Christianity. And I'm saying, well, I know that violence is wrong because Jesus said that my kingdom's not of this world, otherwise my servants would fight. And that the idea of owning someone else is wrong for the exact principle we talked about earlier, that everyone should be made in the image of God. And this seems to be the point that Tom Holland actually makes in his point. He says, many of them Christians over the course of this time have themselves become agents of terror. Christians have done terrible things. They have put the weak in their shadow. They have brought suffering and persecution and slavery in their wake. Yet the standards by which they stand condemned for this are themselves Christian. Nor, even if churches across the West continue to empty, does it seem likely that these standards will quickly change. And then he quotes, God chose the weak things of the world to shame the strong. This is the myth that we in the West still persist in clinging to. Christendom, in that sense, remains Christendom still. So his point is, yes, Christians have done terrible things, but the judgment that we make that those things are terrible is of itself coming from Christianity. We're judging these Christians who've done the wrong thing by the standards of Christianity. Okay, so if you've been completely bored in the last half an hour, I'll try and summarize the argument, which I hope has broadly made sense. So the broad thrust is as follows. Christianity, I would argue, has had a significant influence on the way that Westerners think and act today, whether you are a Christian believer or not. It doesn't really matter. Lots of the way you think, the fundamentals about human life or morality, or even the way that the economic growth in the West has happened, probably because partly at least of the stable unit of a family, these things are influencing the way we think today. The sanctity of life and Western morality have Christian underpinnings. And I would say this is true for Christians and non-Christians. It's just the air we breathe. What the argument doesn't say is that Christians are better people than non-Christians. You'd hope that they would be, but they're not always. It doesn't say that Christianity is the only influence on the way we think. It doesn't say that Christianity is true because it influences our thinking. And it doesn't say that Christianity has a brilliant history of exclusively encouraging human progress. There's been plenty of times when that's not been the case. But I think the argument is useful just because I think it just gently starts to underpick some of the fundamental thinking that you might come into contact with people who've maybe never even thought about religion. And that you may be in the audience now. I think this is a good challenge to just go, why do I believe that human beings are all equal and that they are special? What is the basis on which I think that things are good and evil rather than just sort of all right and not all right? Like what's the reason for viewing the world through a moral code? So just before I finish, what's the point? Where does this leave us all? So what? Well, the so what for me often comes back to this man here, Jesus of Nazareth. And I'm sure on many other occasions you've covered the kind of historical evidence as to why we think he lived and the amazing things you think he did. But for now, I'm just going to sort of, again, quote someone who maybe doesn't always agree with us on Jesus of Nazareth. This is a book written by a man called Paul Offit, and he wrote a long book where he was trying to highlight how bad faith communities are when it comes to science and health stuff. And I think this is quite an interesting introduction to why he writes the book. And he says, independent of whether you believe in the existence of God, you have to be impressed with the man described as Jesus of Nazareth. At the time of Jesus' life, around 4 BC to 30 AD, child abuse, as noted by one historian, was the crying vice of the Roman Empire. Infanticide, killing of children, was common. Abandonment was common. Children were property, no different than slaves. But Jesus stood up for children, cared about them when those around him typically didn't. And his point is, he actually says at the start of his book, I intentionally went out to try and find out that everything comes back for Jesus and he's a terrible man. And he comes to this point where actually I was completely impressed with this man. And he still goes on to say there's a lot of faith communities who don't deal well with health stuff and science. But I think that's an extraordinary acknowledgement that he thinks, actually, if you go back to the source here, not what Christians do today or what they did in the Crusades, actually, you can't help but be impressed by this individual. And he was someone who said, my kingdom's not from the world. Don't fight. That's not the way you should do. That's something very different to, for example, when you look at someone like Muhammad from the Islamic faith. Or this is another thing that Jesus says. He says, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, so you may be the sons of your Father in heaven. And Jesus himself, this man who, as he just, that historian sort of acknowledged, is a really impressive man. He really, I would suggest, stands as an extraordinary model of self-control, of kindness, of love to his enemies. So when we see actions done by Christians that are evil, we go back to the source, I would argue, and that's how we evaluate the sort of the truthfulness around Christianity of what it might be. And the interesting for me is Jesus himself anchors his morality in something even bigger, which is God. Look at the end of that little quote there. You must be perfect. Why? As your heavenly Father is perfect. So I would suggest that if we are willing to honestly evaluate sort of Christianity and acknowledge its sort of tentacles in our life, the place to start would be Jesus, and Jesus in turn will direct us to God. His morality is anchored in God himself. So why do I, John, this random Christian who's talking tonight, think that human beings are special? It's because Jesus believed in God. Jesus believed that God had done something. And what did God do? He created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him male and female. That's why I personally believe that every human being has a value. Men, women, whether you're born with a disability or not, that's the foundational reason. I'm really confident that's why I think it. That's the reason for believing that human beings are special or whatever else it might be about humanity. So I think for those of us who are believers, this is quite a helpful thing. This is the sort of anchor on which we rest. It's Jesus, the foundation of our faith, as he's described. And for me, he is the person who challenges me to think about the way I live, that challenges the way I evaluate the world. I think he's described here in Hebrews as the word of God as living and active, sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing to the division of soul and spirit, of joints and marrow, and discerning the thoughts and intentions of the heart. He understands us. He was a human being like us. He knows what we're like. He knows we make mistakes. We do good things. We do evil things. But the benefit we have is that we can go to God through him. And that's the point at the end. Let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need. So I've whizzed through that tonight. I hope some of that was at least useful. And if you want the copy of the slides, because I raced through it too quickly, you're very welcome. But hopefully the broad principle's there. Christianity influences everyone today. Obviously, as believers, we hope it really influences every aspect of our life. But it might just be a conversational topic that might be useful to pick up with others who maybe don't share our faith.